From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. It's summertime. We ask what kind of parenting, play, and approach to childhood free time is productive for kids. Then, when Darius Clark Monroe was 16, he robbed a bank with two friends. He was caught and served 3 years in prison. Years later, with a film camera in hand, he returned to the scene to explore why he did what he did. We talk with him. Plus, theater critic J.1 Resick reviews The World is Round, a stage adaptation of Gertrude Stein's novella of the same name, brought to life by two Baltimore theater groups, the Acme Corporation and Annex Theater. And Baltimore novelist Jill Morrow, who grew up in Annapolis, tells us why she set her latest twisty tale of fortunes and seances in Newport, Rhode Island. First News.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning, it's Maryland Morning on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. In April, Montgomery County Police picked up two children on their way home from a park in downtown Silver Spring. Their parents, Alexander and Danielle Mateve, said they were unable to find their kids for more than 6 hours as their 10-year-old son Rafi and 6-year-old daughter Dvorah sat in a police cruiser, then in a police station and in the custody of County Child Protective Services. Charges of child neglect were dropped 2 weeks ago. But the Mateves situation sparked a national conversation about what parenting styles we value as a society. And it raised important questions about when parenting crosses the line from hands-off to irresponsible. Here's part of how ABC News in April covered the debate surrounding the Mateves' kids and whether they should be allowed to walk home from school alone.
Two police cars pull up over here.
The Montgomery County Police gave the kids, ages 6 and 10, a stern warning.
It made me feel annoyed and embarrassed.
The cops reported the parents to Child Protective Services, who threatened to take the kids away.
Maryland parents are accused of child neglect after allowing their two kids to walk home alone from a park about a mile away.
Suddenly, this middle-class suburban family found themselves smack in the middle of a national debate about parenting.
Now summer is here. Kids have more free time. So we're revisiting the conversation we had in April about what kind of parenting, play, and approach to childhood free time is productive for children. We spoke with Katie Robinson, a parent and social worker who runs a consulting firm that works with families on childhood behavioral issues, and also with Patricia Cronin, executive director since 1999 of The Family Tree. It's a nonprofit in Baltimore that works to prevent child abuse and neglect. The Mateves' children were 10 and 6 in April. I asked Patricia Cronin to tell us what signposts parents might see developmentally at those ages to know whether their kids are ready for less supervision.
Well, they should look for how they make decisions. Simple things that they do around the house, if they can follow tasks in the house, and it's, you know, a good idea that they would be able to follow instructions when they're not in the house. If they're able to do a couple of tasks at a time, then they probably could cross the street safely. So I think parents can observe their children right under their own supervision in their home and their yard and begin to make judgments about how they could approach tasks when they're not away from them.
Katie, what can kids learn being on their own that they can't learn in a classroom or in a structured play?
I think that kids learn from each other very differently than they learn from adults. Adults can be very quick to help. Not that children don't do the same thing necessarily, but kids working together or kids being on their own just means that they have to be more reliant on themselves, right? They have to figure out if they're frustrated, how they push through frustration to either solve a problem or decide that it's too difficult for them. They have to start making decisions for themselves and really test their capability. Not that it wouldn't happen if adults were around or if they were supervised. It's not impossible that those two things coincide. But giving them a little more space to do it on their own means that they will just have more opportunity to figure out what they're capable of doing.
Do kids who are allowed periods of unsupervised play experience less anxiety?
We know for certain that children who don't benefit from play with their peers, that those children do suffer all kinds of problems, that play is an essential part of a child's cognitive growth, their academic growth, and really help spur brain development. So it is an essential building block. And sometimes in our rush for kids to grow academically, we forget that. So I think I think that it certainly helps them emotionally and to deal with all kinds of things. It's their work. It's their work. Play is a child's work.
The events were the second time the Matives had a run-in with Montgomery County Child Protective Services. Something similar took place last December, and the Matives after that were found responsible for, quote, unsubstantiated, close quote, child neglect. Patricia, both times the police got involved after a concerned neighbor called the police.
Yeah.
How important is having a community to fostering both safety and constructive experiences where kids can be unsupervised?
Parents rely on people in the community to look out for their kids. We can't expect government to be take the role in keeping our children safe. So I think the community members are really important to provide that safety net because they can't be, parents cannot be the eyes all the time.
I agree with that. And I read a quote from the mother, Mrs. Matev, saying that the reason that she feels strongly about allowing her kids to explore the world as they do, and sometimes on their own, is because she wants to show them that she trusts them. And I think that in communities, we also would like to show our kids that they should trust other adults, and we would like to show other adults that we trust them too, because we're letting our children walk down the block in front of their house, whatever it may be. If they do see something wrong, then we hope that we can all be working together, you know, to watch out for the kids, but that we trust each other, right? The only way to kind of foster trust is to try it out, is to
embrace it.
Exactly. Give a little bit. Sometimes you have to act like you trust a little more than you actually do to really test it.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Katie Robinson, a parent and social worker who works with families on childhood behavioral issues, and Patricia Cronin, executive director of the Family Tree, a nonprofit in Baltimore. She studied psychology and early childhood education as well as social work. How can the broader community, police force, social services, neighbors, friends, be aware when less supervision becomes neglect?
Well, I think just simple questioning, you know, asking a child, where are your parents? You know, can you call them if you are severely concerned? We don't have a total agreement about what neglect looks like unless it's very obvious, you know, unless a child is not dressed or doesn't have medical care or clothes. If it's a child, you know, find out where their adult is. And I don't think we necessarily have to assume that a child's neglected. If the parent isn't right there, I think that we can assume to get that child to a caregiver that will provide safety to them.
Let's hear from something Danielle Matev told the Washington Post.
For us, free-range kids means nothing very radical. It means we're giving our children the childhood that we had, the idea that kids can be trusted to go down the block, to play at the park, to walk home from school. So we let them, you know, within carefully defined boundaries, walk around outside, play outside, interact with people, basically encounter the world on their own.
Katie, how did the free range label come about if a generation ago kids had far more freedom than they do today? I mean, I remember when I was growing up,
yeah.
I walked alone. I rode my bicycle miles away from
mm-hmm.
home at age probably 7, 8, 9.
Mm-hmm. Those definitely seem to be the stories, yes.
So how did this free range tag come to be?
It seems to me, right, that there has been, as maybe suburbs have grown or the need for cars have grown or whatever it may be, competition has grown in schools and expectations for kids. There's been more focus on, right, structured activities, making sure that your kid has a certain amount of extracurricular activities, certain things like this that we want to prepare them for the world. And the world is getting harder. So letting them be by themselves or on their own seems to be a risk that we can't take. There has been a talk of helicopter parenting.
Which is sort of the reverse.
Right, yeah. Right. That I think, to my knowledge, that vernacular was around prior to this free range idea.
I think so too.
Right.
Yeah.
So I don't know if free range is a result of or a kind of a reaction to what we think of as helicopter parenting, or tiger momming is also another way that we call it. But it seems to me somebody finally is kind of pushing back against the direction that especially middle class parents seem to be going in, which is, you know, more structure, more activity, more supervision and parental eyes, and they're kind of going in the opposite direction, and that's causing this strange imbalance.
Well, and certainly much of this is parental philosophy. Some of it, though, is in law. What does state law actually tell parents about when it's okay to have an older child supervising a younger child?
Maryland gives us guidance that children under 8 need to be supervised by another child at least 13 or another adult. So, and that's, you know, guidance because obviously that has to, you have to have the assumption that the 13-year-old is competent to do so. So, but that's pretty much what our state would offer.
So, takeaway thoughts. If you're a parent who values what you're hearing but is also concerned about safety, what are some suggestions for such parents about how to incorporate values of self-reliance and independence and exploration and still keep your kids safe?
Well, I think parents know their children the best, and they have to really honor the values in their family and their community. So they need to really understand just what their child is capable of, what kind of directions they're able to follow, what kind of peer pressure they're able to respond to, particularly as children get a little bit older. They're much more at risk to respond to peer pressure more so than what the instructions the parent gave them. So I think the parent has to really assess what the child is capable of and the decisions that they can make, what they could do if there was a problem, an unavoidable problem or an unexpected problem, and just say how they handle that and make those kinds of decisions and then try it out in small ways before a big task is given them.
Katie, what are your takeaway thoughts?
It's basically that too. Practice. You can practice any of these ideas in very small bits. You can practice at home. You can, if you always check on your child after 5 minutes of them playing by themselves in another room, stretch it to 6. Try out 10 one day. See what happens. You know, you don't have to send them out into the world just to make them more independent. You can take steps back to give them more room, even while you're still operating in the same space. You can trust them to start on their homework by themselves without first reading the directions with them. You know, little ways you can take steps back that really will help kids grow without demanding that they go to the park by themselves.
Yeah. I think parents want their children to be resilient and capable, and there are lots of strategies that parents can deploy for that to happen. And I think families have to make those decisions that they're comfortable with and they're willing to take those kinds of responsibilities.
Thank you both.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
It was a pleasure.
Katie Robinson is a parent and social worker. She works with families on childhood behavioral issues. Patricia Cronin is executive director of the nonprofit The Family Tree for more than 15 years. We spoke in April. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. There's more ahead. Stay with us on 88.1.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. When Darius Clark Monroe was 16, he and two friends robbed a bank at gunpoint. They were caught. Darius cut a plea bargain and was sentenced to 5 years in prison. While incarcerated, he earned a GED and started working on a college degree. He was released after 3 years, finished college, and went on to study filmmaking at New York University. In his new documentary film, Evolution of a Criminal, Monroe turns the camera on himself and his family, friends, and community to explore that life-altering decision he made to rob a bank as a teenager in Texas. It's a compelling study in forgiveness and redemption. In late March, we screened the film as part of the Maryland Film Festival WYPR Spotlight series. I spoke with Darius Clark Monroe after the screening in front of a live audience.
To me, Evolution of a Criminal is just truly the exploration to what systemic behavioral and familial influences pushes one to the brink of having to make a choice of committing a bank robbery at the age of 16 years old. And
What were some of those pressures? You were an honor student. I mean, mm-hmm. You say in the film things were going well for you.
Yeah, things were definitely going well. But at the time, 15, 16 years old, our home was recently burglarized. I was an honor student. But at that moment in my life, I was still very much aware of the fact that my family had been living paycheck to paycheck my whole life. And it wasn't just my parents. When I talk about my family, I'm talking about my aunts, my uncles, my grandparents. And these were people who got up every day and worked hard every single day, early in the morning, came home late, who sacrificed for many, many years. And I just couldn't understand at that age why it was taking us so long to get out of this stagnant place. And I couldn't figure out what it was. And I think when our home was burglarized, that just really, it saddened me, but it also just pushed me to make a choice, because I just felt like that home burglary just set us back, and I never knew if we were ever going to be able to recover.
Make a choice.
To make a choice to do the robbery, to do something, because I was working part-time. I was in high school, and I just felt like my part-time job was not helping at all in terms of just our finances at home. And so I made the choice to do something, which was the bank robbery.
In the film, your mother blames herself several times for confiding in you about the pressures, the financial pressures the family was under. Was that the real reason that you chose to do this robbery?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it wasn't because of the family pressures, definitely not because of not due to the fact that she spoke to me and told me. Although I felt like that didn't help, I was old enough to also be cognizant of my surroundings, my environment. And so I knew things were hard, and it just, you know, when you feel like things are not ever going to become easy, a robbery may seem like an extreme thing to do, but for me it was the easiest thing because I just was obsessed with getting the money, and I was trying to figure out, well, what was the quickest way to get money to help this problem so it can go away as fast as possible, because it's been going on for my whole entire life up until that point. And so the robbery was just a means to an end.
And that end was?
That end was to pay bills, to get our house, get the rent paid, get my aunt's home out of foreclosure, just get money on the table to take care of some of the things that we were needing.
Describe your mother's reaction
to the robbery.
When you showed up. Yeah. No, after you'd done the robbery, mm-hmm. and showed up with the cash.
It's interesting because my mother was, it was one of those things where she was filled with terror and paranoia. She also was so confused. It's hard for me to describe, and I don't even think I could. The actress who played her in the reenactment could really nail exactly, because it was just a multitude of different extreme emotions all at once. But the biggest thing is that she was afraid that I was going to get arrested immediately. Her and my stepfather kept, you know, talking about the fact that they were expecting a SWAT team to come in anytime and knock down the door and arrest me, and they were concerned. For my safety, they were concerned about the safety of, you know, they wanted to know what happened to the people inside of the bank. How did it happen? But they were terrified, but they weren't terrified enough to, call the police, which I understand why. But they were terrified.
The film paints how the word spread, as one of your aunts says, the word spread like butter. But several weeks passed. Mm-hmm. And you say in the film that when the police showed up at your classroom, your teenage brain did not connect it to the bank robbery that you'd pulled off 4 weeks earlier.
Right, and it's it may seem crazy, but, you know, Too Short, Officer Walton, who we call Too Short, that's someone we see all the time at the high school. And so when he stepped into the classroom, when I saw his face, he was a very familiar face. And so I wasn't thinking at the time that he was coming to arrest me. It had been almost 4 weeks. And when I realized that he was in the classroom to arrest me, that's when the reality of everything started to come around. But it was scary for me because up until that point, I've never dealt with the police in my whole life. That was the first time I was being arrested. And so I didn't know what the protocol was, and I didn't know how I was supposed to feel. And because it had gone on for so many days post-robbery, the paranoia that I was feeling started to dissipate. And I was starting to just get back into my own normal schedule and everything with school. And yeah, I was in a bit of shock when he came.
You robbed this bank at gunpoint with a shotgun, unloaded, but the folks in the bank didn't know that. Mm-hmm. When did it dawn on you that you had transgressed against these people, and what did you think you owed them?
Initially, because we were in that bank for maybe a minute and a half max, everything truly felt like a blur. And there was one woman who was a customer, and I'll never forget her face. She was the first person I saw, and she was squatted down just right up under like the deposit slips. And I always thought about her for many, many years. And I thought about everybody inside of that bank, but the day of the robbery, I was truly focused on getting the money. I had no interest in who the people were inside that place. I didn't want to have a whole lot of conversation. We didn't talk, we didn't touch, but I wanted to get the money and get out. But right after the robbery, going to prison, and many years after prison, I always struggled with the fact that I'd committed a crime against these people who were innocent folks, who were people who were just trying to go do their banking business and people who were working. And I felt like they deserved an apology. And initially, it wasn't supposed to be a film. I just wanted to apologize, but it sort of coincided with the fact that I was a third-year graduate student at the time when I realized I wanted to go back and apologize and somehow use that as a part of a much larger film.
And it was your friend and fellow student and cinematographer who said this should be a film?
He was. I mean, he did. And he was a cinematographer, and it makes sense. And he was a fellow film student. Because when I approached him, it really was on something genuine. It was just about an apology, about me going back down to Houston. And he was the one who said, you know, maybe you should pick up a camera and some sound equipment and shoot whatever this is that you're trying to explore.
That's filmmaker Darius Clark Monroe here on the Maryland Film Festival WIPR Spotlight. We're talking about his autobiographical documentary, Evolution of a Criminal. You really don't dwell much in the film on the prison experience. Mm-hmm. What is your view about the effectiveness of incarceration as a deterrent or as a way of paying society back?
I mean, I feel like the current prison industrial complex that's present here in the States and it's been going on for many, many years does not work. I feel like, you know, I didn't rehabilitate because there was something in the prison that forced me to do it. It's because there are individuals who are other inmates who were positive and who were self-motivating and driven. And I surrounded myself around those individuals and we pushed forward and continued to do the work. But there was nothing in that place that pushed us to do better or to quote unquote rehabilitate. And I think, you know, the places where you go to be destroyed and where you go to lose your dreams and lose your voice, but that place is not. There's nothing positive to me about that experience. There was nothing positive about, you know, incarceration. It was damaging. It felt like it was set up to destroy me. It felt like it was set up to destroy the spirit of all of those men that was in that place. And that was the spirit of the entire unit. It didn't seem like there was anything that was fruitful or uplifting about that whole entire experience.
In terms of penitence, it seems as if your real experience was not the 3 years you spent in prison, but the 7 years you spent making this film.
I would agree, yeah. And I mean, the 3 years were tough, but working on this film and realizing that my family had not really gone to therapy, that I hadn't gone to therapy or counseling, and that we were doing all of this emotional work on camera for the first time, yeah, that was tough.
You don't talk a lot in the film about race. Mm-hmm. You do mention the experience of, as a prisoner working in the fields, mm-hmm. a black man forced to pick cotton in Texas. Mm-hmm. But then you quickly also talk about what it's like for somebody who's 6'2" and 300 pounds mm-hmm. to have to stoop down to pick cotton. So you kind of almost pull back. What is the message, or is there a message?
Racially?
About race.
I mean, the reason why it wasn't like a big, bold statement is because it's, you know, race and racism is pervasive in this country. And I wanted to make a film that showed this family, and the family was set within the context of this country, this whatever this racial construct is in this country, I know that the story exists within that, and the audience that was coming to watch this film would be informed about the systemic issues that were in place. There have been so many films I saw that focused on systemic issues and focused on percentages and pie charts, and I knew that I was making a film that was talking about race and class and the prison industrial complex, but I also felt as a storyteller that I didn't have to say it out loud and beat the audience over the head. I feel like they would get it. They would understand that if there's a black family and everybody in the family is struggling and everyone is working hard and this is going on for generations and centuries, that clearly is, we're talking about a racial construct. We're definitely talking about classism and racism. I don't have to say it. I'm just showing the people. I'm showing that these are loving, hardworking people who can't access the American dream. And so it's the audience, the onus is on the audience to do that extra work and pull it together. But it's all the pieces, to me, are there, especially with the cotton. I didn't have to make it any simpler in terms of prison is a direct extension of slavery and Jim Crow, and picking cotton has nothing to do with rehabilitation. It is there to psychologically destroy and to defeat you and to demean and degrade.
Who is it you hope will see this film?
I mean, I hope as many people as possible, but I'm really hoping that young people, especially young black men and women, young girls and boys who are currently in a similar situation that I was in, or who are headed in that path, or who have already made that mistake and feel discouraged and feel like they can't accomplish their dreams, their life is over, they're a second-class citizen. Even though it's going to be difficult, I wanted to make an example of, show an example of what it's like to still try to move forward and progress even under the umbrella of oppression.
Darius Clark Monroe. His film is called Evolution of a Criminal. We spoke in front of a live audience in late March as part of the Maryland Film Festival WYPR Spotlight Series. Evolution of a Criminal is available on Netflix and iTunes. We've got more information at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay right here on 88.1.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Maryland Morning, I'm Tom Hall. The Acme Theater Corporation and the Annex Theater have teamed up for a production of a play called The World is Round. Maryland Morning theater critic J. Wynn Russick has been to Station North to see it, and here's her review.
Even if you're only slightly familiar with Gertrude Stein, you've probably heard her most famous quote, "A rose is a rose is a rose." But you may not know that Rose was the name of the little girl protagonist in a children's book that Stein published in 1939, called The World is Round. Two Baltimore theater companies, Annex Theater and the Acme Corporation, have brought Rose to life in a splendidly inventive original stage adaptation of The World is Round. A children's book by Gertrude Stein is far from typical kid lit, so it's fitting that the stage version, adapted and directed by Acme's Lola B. Pearson, is daring, experimental, and full of unexpected juxtapositions. Think Gertrude Stein meets Samuel Beckett and Mr. Rogers and Harry Potter and Mary Poppins.
If the world was round, would a lion fall off? A lion fall off, lion fall off. If the world was round, would a lion fall off? In the most delightful way.
Gertrude Stein's book has an odd, rather disjointed plot. Rose has two dogs and a cousin named Willie, who gives her a lion. Rose learns in school that the world is round, which makes her sad. Rose likes to sing, but singing makes her cry. Rose decides to climb a mountain. Stein's simple, repetitive language has a childlike quality, and its rhythms and repetitions make it well-suited to music. Songwriter Jen Wassner, one of the founders of the Baltimore band Y Oak, has composed a haunting, layered score. A great deal of the show is sung. Rose is played by an adult, Cricket Arison, who brings a matter-of-fact tone to her singing and an almost severe presence to her acting. The opening song introduces Rose's serious-minded, questioning attitude. When the show's five-member chorus joins in, the effect suggests the way questions circle around and recur in a child's mind.
I am a little girl, my name is Rose. Why am I a little girl? Why is my name Rose? I am a little
Rose. I'm not sure why Rose is portrayed primarily as an observer instead of a participant. Arison spends much of the 45-minute play seated to one side, with the chorus occupying most of the stage. Perhaps this is intended to suggest that Rose is a child more given to thinking than action. But it would help the audience engage with her if she were less stationary. Pearson, the show's director and adapter, incorporates choral, often overlapping speech, as well as music. There are also projections and a bit of puppetry. The lion is represented by one chorus member manipulating a wooden lion's head and another manipulating the animal's legs. And a very clever window shade device represents Rose's mountain climb. The whole presentation is highly stylized, including the chorus's movement. Rose is a lonelier child on stage than she is in Stein's book. But just as Rose comes to accept that, to quote the title, the world is round, she also finds her place in it and someone to share it with. I read Gertrude Stein's book before seeing the show, which undoubtedly made it more comprehensible. The production, like the book, is less concerned with traditional narrative than with capturing a child's sense of wonder. It does that, and also embodies Gertrude Stein's sparse poetic language. It's an impressive achievement.
You can catch The World is Round at St. Mark's Evangelical Lutheran Church on St. Paul Street in the Station North Arts and Entertainment District until Sunday. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins us with her reviews every Monday morning here on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. Stay with us.
If you have thoughts on that segment you just heard, email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Now we'll meet a Baltimore author who set her new novel in a seaport with a picturesque historic district, a harbor full of yachts, and occasional sightings of sailors in smart military uniforms. Readers cannot spare much attention for the town, though, because they're pulled immediately into a complex drama of rich people behaving badly, or at least behaving mysteriously, even beyond the grave. The creator of this intricate plot and the characters who move it along is Jill Morrow, who earned her bachelor's in history at Towson University and her law degree at the University of Baltimore. And Jill Morrow is with me in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So, okay, you grew up in Annapolis.
I did.
And I read that when you started writing this novel, it was set in Annapolis.
It was. I wanted to do that so badly.
And then it changed.
Yes,
explain
it
what
did.
Happened.
Annapolis, when I set the novel, I even had places in mind. I had houses in mind. And I love Annapolis. But it proved to be too small a canvas for the characters that were developing in my mind and too small a canvas for the story. I needed the mansions.
the mansions. The influx of wealth in Newport that kind of overwhelms everything else that you don't get in another.
Yes, yes. So I set the story in Newport because in addition to that beautiful water view, which also got bigger because I had the Atlantic Ocean as well. So I just needed a slightly bigger stage.
You also moved the time setting from 1910.
I did.
Past the global war, what we now call the First World War, past the beginning of Prohibition, and set this novel in 1921.
You're probably figuring out by now that the original novel that I started writing changed, evolved. And I found that as this novel came to me, 1921 was the perfect setting because I needed to add a spirit in here. I needed spiritualism. And 1921 saw a great resurgence in spiritualism because of everybody lost during the First World War, during the flu epidemic of 1918, 1919. All of a sudden, you had a lot of people who were desperate to get in touch with those that had been taken from them so suddenly. And so 1921 became a more plausible time period in which to set this. And once I did that, I found out I loved it. I loved the period. It was so much fun. And the characters seemed to like it, too. They came to life.
I have the impression your characters lead you along, that they basically dictate the novel. Is that an oversimplification?
No. Actually, they do tend to dictate the novel. They don't go the extra yard and tell me exactly what's going on. I wish they would. But yes, if I can trust the creative process, then my characters do seem to have a lot to tell me.
Does it follow from that that you don't know how the novel's going to turn out until it turns out?
With Newport, I did not know. And I wondered. The novel I'm currently writing is the first time I've ever known where it's going. And I think I like it better.
That's Baltimore novelist Jill Morrow here on WIPR, Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the novel she's publishing tomorrow, her third. It's titled Newport. More than most fiction, as I read Newport, I found myself brought up short time after time by some detail in the past of one of the characters or other that I really had not expected. So I am terrified of spoiling it for listeners who may read the book. So how can we tell listeners what Newport is about?
I suppose we could start safely and say that Newport is set in 1921. It involves a lawyer named Adrian and his associate, Jim, who have been summoned to an opulent summer cottage in Newport to revise the will of their most wealthy client. And of course, they're hoping this goes smoothly, and naturally it does not, or we wouldn't have a book, correct? They find the will is contested by the spoiled brat adult children of the octogenarian client, and they have a point when they say that their father should be claimed insane because, and I don't think this is spoiling too much, to say that the client is planned to marry a much younger woman, but not only is he planning to marry her, he's been directed to marry her by his first wife. His first wife, Elizabeth, who has been dead for 35 years.
How does Elizabeth interact with the other characters?
Elizabeth is channeled via seance. The bride-to-be, Catherine, and her niece, Amy, make these seances happen. And Amy claims to be able to speak for Elizabeth. And Elizabeth mostly has one thing to say, and that is, marry Catherine. Marry Catherine as soon as you can.
Marry Catherine and include her in your will.
Yes, absolutely. That is why we are revising the will. So that looks suspicious, we might say.
These are pretty interesting characters, all the rest of them, even without the element of spiritualism and seances. So why did you feel it was important to include that?
I included it based on a tidbit I read early, which involved Victoria Woodhull and Tennessee Claflin. And what they did in 1870 is they opened a stockbroker firm, but they were backed by Cornelius Vanderbilt, who they began doing seances for, because he was mourning the loss of his beloved first wife, and they caught him at a good time. And I started thinking, what would make people so desperate that they would believe everything that spiritualists said? And that's what people did do. So once that was in the DNA of the story, what really helped is that spiritualism leveled the field between the classes so that my wealthy characters looked at my less wealthy characters in a different way because they had something to offer. And also, nobody of any class had any protection against Elizabeth because...
Elizabeth the dearly departed.
Wife. Yes. So they were all vulnerable where she was concerned. They couldn't keep secrets. They couldn't pull on class background. And I thought that was an interesting addition to the story.
So one of the less wealthy characters is the intended bride of the octogenarian, Catherine Walsh. What do you want people to learn from her story?
She's a prickly character.
Uh-huh.
She's not always likable. But I would like people to look beyond what they see in the present and recognize what it would have been like for her as a woman growing up in the situations in which she found herself. Catherine had class issues and gender issues that helped create who she became. And I would like people to see Catherine as a full character and not just the prickles on the surface.
You are a lawyer. Is that why Adrienne de la Noy is a lawyer?
You know, my protagonist in the first two books was a lawyer, too. And as I get further out from having practiced, it fades. Adrienne was a lawyer because, first of all, I knew what he was doing, but also his personality was so constrained in so many ways that I thought it was easier for him to stay that way in a profession that required minute research, interpretation. It just fit him. I think he just arrived as a lawyer.
So this book started out to be set in Annapolis and then Annapolis disappeared. Is there going to be a book set in Annapolis?
I hope there is somewhere down the line. Right now, there's not. I even see the house I wanted in. I'm hoping that happens sometime.
What can you tell us about the book you're working on now?
I can tell you that it takes place in pre-code Hollywood, which is 1930 to 1934. That's pretty much all I can tell you. It's tentatively entitled The Road to You.
Congratulations on this book, and thanks for talking to us about it.
Thank you. It's been a delight.
Jill Morrow's novel, to be published tomorrow, is titled Newport. She'll be speaking about it Wednesday night at the Ivy Bookshop in Falls Road. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Marilyn Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Marilyn Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy
and Jonna McCone.
We have production help from
Mary Wiltenberg,
Christy Forrest,
and Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in history, 1776, the Maryland Convention, before word had reached them about the national vote in Philadelphia, declared the colony's independence from Britain. We're back on Wednesday. Please join us.